1 0 1 0 0 0 1 0 1 0 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0 1 0
And a good evening.
Welcome to Signal Hackerspaces.
Yeah, for our listeners in Vienna, it's evening, but of course people in the States or whatever who are downloading this might be listening in the morning, so good morning, good afternoon, whatever.
Actually, we are sitting here in Vienna in the studio of Radio Orange, and it's a Sunday afternoon, and we're quite tired because we had a big hacker conference this weekend.
I think exhausted is the right word.
It's not even coping all of my feelings. They're intense and tiring, and but it was a great time. And yeah, we started on Friday to prepare the space. Saturday, nearly a whole day.
Yeah, well, Friday was late. Then Saturday, the whole day conference.
Then party.
Yeah, which also lasted until the birds started tweeting again. So yeah, we're tired, but that didn't stop us from driving around Vienna, because, well, I'm not from Vienna, of course, I'm from the Netherlands, I'm like touring Europe at the moment, doing some visits to hackerspaces, and, well, you are from Vienna, so you've been showing me around, you've been lazy, like driving around in the car.
Yeah, eating cake and schnitzel at Stefan's Platz.
And discussing the cultural aspects of servant personnel at cafes, right?
Oh yeah, Viennese coffeehouse culture. You somehow have to explain to foreigners why those fucking waiters are so unfriendly. And you tried to convince me of Dutch cuisine. Honestly, it didn't work, but I'm going to visit Den Haag, and then you can convince me again.
We're going to the beach when it's 36 degrees and we're going to eat some ette soup, and then you'll totally get it out of context because it's a winter dish.
Okay. Convince me then. But yeah, what about NinjaCon or Security B-Sites or PlumberCon?
Yeah, so I was wondering, how long has this been going on, actually, the NinjaCon?
We started 2009. It was basically Estera's idea to start a hacker conference. The whole thing started off as a joke about some accident that happened in Nick Farr's flat in Washington. And I don't want to go into it, but the topic of plumbing was involved.
Well, I think it involved chemicals, a certain toilet, and, well, total breakage.
Thank you for the non-disclosure. And yeah, definitely this LOL conference idea became an actual hacker conference that now has been taking place in Vienna for 3 years now, and started off as PlumberCon. Then we became a friendly copyright infringement from Nintendo and changed the name to NinjaCon. The first 2 years we stayed at Werkzeugkar. It's quite a nice place for hanging out, but not so much for doing a conference. And so we decided on the third time we're doing this conference, on the third year, that we're going to move to another place. And so we came to the Hub. That's actually a co-working space here in Vienna, also one of the oldest. And yeah, it's quite a nice place and very, very large. We also had, I don't know how many participants, around 100, 120.
Probably, I haven't counted them, but... But this whole thing about the copyright infringement, that actually happened. I thought it was sort of a joke.
No, it did.
So you cannot use the word plumber?
We also had Mario in the logo on the homepage.
Oh, well, no. Yeah, then it's then you're basically asking for it.
Yeah.
No, but it was a nice airy room. Like, but the talks were also great, I think. I've heard some nice things.
Yeah, you did the audio at Area 1 at the main stage, and I did the session chair on Area 2 and also coordinated the volunteers. And so I was, of course, quite involved in the talks I moderated, but didn't got any clue at all from what happened at your area.
No, and that was actually quite an... I never see any talks at conferences because I'm always running around helping organize. And this time I was also working, but I was just sitting in the room the whole way. That was a nice change, actually.
Yeah, but also, I mean, you did the audio. At least you heard most of the talks.
All of them.
Okay.
In track one, at least. I did miss a few in your area because there was this guy talking about how to become a cyber terrorist.
Oh, yeah. It was, what's his name again? Mark?
I don't know.
UK guy, very, very funny. We also had him last year on the conference. And he's just a brilliant speaker. He is a very distinct character. I think you have to like him, but he is... kind of typical British party monster, but also someone with deep thoughts and able to entertain an audience and at the same time still transport some curious type of ironic wisdom. And cyber terrorism for him was a topic he chose because, obviously cyber, he talked a lot about the nature of this word and that fact that you should no longer use it, and terrorism also... He made a quite interesting comparison between cyber, between terrorism and advertising. They have something in common. They try to influence public opinion by more or less completely unrelated actions. Actions that basically just want to draw public opinion and bring a message to the people when they have their attention. And he is quite right with that. And also when you look at another level, also terrorism itself becomes a kind of issue and sign for all our politicians who use it as an argument.
Also, it's funny that you mentioned it. I was thinking back of this when I was waiting for the bill at the terrace, just in the center of the Stefan Dome.
Stefansdom.
Yeah, we were sitting there. You were taking care of some business in the back of the cafe, and so I was looking at, and it's being restored, which it's apparently is always going on. But at the same time, I noticed we had a conversation earlier. Like, if you put graffiti on the church, you will be killed on the without asking questions on the spot, you know. And but at the same time, I was looking at the church and. There's advertisements on there, you know, on the that they have this plastic so that you have a fake facade and can see what's behind it. But there are advertisements, so I can't put my graffiti on there, but terrorist marketing can.
Yeah, terrorist marketing. I don't know which companies put their ads on the cover of those currently under replacement parts. But the point is, the Stephansdom is the central symbol of Austria. It is in the geographical center of the first district of the capital city, and it is a symbol. It was during the Second World War completely destroyed and then rebuilt. And the funny thing is that because it's such a symbol, you always have police around. And there's also quite some surveillance around it. And it's also a spot often used for demonstrations and flash mobs and stuff like that. So it is interesting. Somehow it is not the point where you have the most, you don't have many demonstrations there in the sense of everyone is going there. It's not the place to argue anything. It's more tourist area and totally different than the real Vienna when you go to the outer districts where the actual life is taking place, where the interesting spots are and where people are working and living and not only going to see what Vienna is supposed to mean.
Yeah, and we also went to another place that that has seen some demonstrations. I don't know where the parliament is, the government and the Great Palace. The National Library was on the right, and we
the
balcony where I don't know if I can even mention the name, but some
Heldenplatz.
Guy.
The Heroes Place translated. This is actually the big park in front of the Hofburg. On the right side, you have the National Library, where also this you can see the very famous balcony where Hitler spoke on the unification of Austria with Germany. And the whole Heldenplatz was packed full with people. Quite a dramatic and historical yeah. pictures that took place there. And the Heldenplatz is one of these centers where you can somehow feel the powers, and you can somehow feel what it means to govern and to control the people. And in recent years, it had another specific piece of history that was added when the right-wing government in Austria under Schüssel came into power. There is always this ritual that the new government has to go from the Bundeskanzleramt, center of the head of the government, into the Hofburg, where the Bundespräsident is residencing. And the Bundespräsident is similar to the Queen in Netherlands. It is a person with a key role who is not actually in power administratively, but he has to somehow grant many important laws, and also has to put new governments into power.
Yeah, what's interesting about that, actually, because the Queen we have in the Netherlands, she's in that position. She has to install the government. She can send the government home. She's only in that position because she was born as the daughter of the oldest daughter of the previous queen, and the next guy that will be there is there because he was. But in Austria, it's a chosen function. It's a
just get elected every four years.
Yeah,
and the Bundespräsident normally is not into daily politics. Sometimes he makes statements that the government should do this or that, or they should hurry, or they, he should say more often that they actually should make laws that are conformative with the constitution. For example, data retention that he signed and that's passed. But the reason why I mentioned Mr. Fischer, our Bundespräsident, is because it was not Fischer, it was Klestil, the one before. That he had to accept a new government. The government included Haider, this very critical right-wing figure. And the whole Heldenplatz was packed full of demonstrators. So they couldn't get through. They couldn't get from Balding A to Balding B, but they had to, because otherwise they would not officially be the new government. And after a certain time, they just decided that they will go underneath, through a tunnel between these two buildings. Nearly all important buildings in Vienna have underground tunnels to get from A to B. And they used one of those to just pass under the thousands of people who were demonstrating. And then they got elected, and a few shitty years of right conservative governments.
Yeah, well, we're seeing a lot of that in Europe at the moment, I fear. It's,
You can tell us also something about the Netherlands when it comes to that, or?
It's quite funny in the Netherlands. We have a coalition between two parties who did not get a majority vote together. It's the Christians and the Liberals. But meanwhile, they do not have a majority, which you need if you want to effectively run a parliament. So they have a third party. It's the Party of Freedom, with our recent most famous export product, the white-haired Geert Wilders. Mm. And, it's hard to define the Party of Freedom in left or right, because if you look at the social, how they take a stand on social issues, like how we treat our elder, how we deal with funding of education, they are quite social, actually. And that's, meanwhile, but if you go to religion, and especially Islam, well, they are completely right-wing extremist. So that's, it's a populist party, and so they have been dragged into this coalition. They are not taking part of it, but they are the typical Dutch word gedogen. It's sort of tolerate. So it's not tolerate. It's difficult. The same thing we have with the soft drugs. It's allowed, but it's not. It's not allowed, but it's. Anyway, that's really a weird situation, because they take a very strong stand in everything relating to the Islam and Islamic culture, and meanwhile, the Christians take a more pragmatic approach, actually, which also surprised me, towards religion, actually. They accept that there is a lot of Islamic influx in our society, and they don't want to pry at religious freedom, because that would ultimately also backfire on them, of course. So it's quite interesting how this is, and how fragile actually this coalition is, and that it's still there is for me quite a miracle. And the stupid thing is these the Party of Freedom, they have local they also have local councils, like in the city of The Hague. They actually got quite a lot of votes. And well, in the beginning, actually, we had Geert Wilders in the council, but mostly in name. He never showed up. Meanwhile, we had to invest a lot of money in City Hall to make it secure, because, well, if Geert Wilders is coming, then all the actual, because I'm not denying that there are religious nuts, they are might try to get to him, and he never goes anywhere without bodyguards. So we had to invest in I don't know what, thousands of euros, ten thousands of euros, and he never showed up. He never showed up to take a seat in the council. And recently, he just said, "Well, I can't do it," because he's also in the national parliament. So he just resigned, and it's typical of this party. They have a very big mouth. They say a lot of things and strong language, and everyone says, "Yeah, that's what they should do." But if it comes down to it, they really do not have anything constructive to bring to the table. And actually, the thing I have seen that they have most strongly taken on is just cutting all funding to everything that's remotely cultural. They just hate culture. I don't know what's up with that, but they're against spending tax money to culture, to like historic orchestras, the Royal Orchestra that resides in The Hague. It might just stop being able to play because they are cutting the funding, but also more. I don't know, more creative, grassroots, smaller cultural initiatives. Also, getting kids to learn to play an instrument or whatever. That's all. They're just scrapping the funding, and I don't get it. It's not even something they have been talking about, and on the basis of which they have been voted. So I don't know what's up with it. I don't understand these people.
Yeah, it's quite funny. I mean, this new right that developed in Europe, in Austria, when I look at people like Strache from the FPÖ, he's playing a similar game. He is in the national parliament, but he is also running on the elections on the Viennese level, and he wants to be mayor of Vienna, and at the same time, he wants to be chancellor of Austria. They're just populists. They're playing with symbols, and while doing that, they're loading and learning the society full of symbolized religious fears and feelings that we are under danger and under continuous threat from outside, which is actually quite good when you want to build a community, but it's not a good basement to build up a diverse society in which we are living now. And when it comes to culture, I made this remark that in the inner city in Vienna, in the first district, nothing that's not dead for around 100 years is considered as culture. And that's the classical approach in Vienna, that that everything that's traditional is seen as very valuable, and we always like to point out our big, great history we had, and we did. But where was it founded upon? It was founded about diversity and a very inclusive empire that, for example, accepted Islam from the beginning onwards, when we had Islamic people on our territory, and or at least the first state that joined us and officially was Islamic. So there never was an issue about religion or ethnicity. They, of course, ruled these countries, and economically they also draw resources out of them. But it was an awareness that power is always a kind of balanced thing. And I like this African saying that the power is like an egg. If you don't hold it tight enough, you'll lose it. But if you hold it too tight, then it will burst. And similarly, maybe our politicians just totally forgot the nature of their element. somehow like the
maybe
idea.
Yeah, it's, but as long as we the people tolerate it, the egg won't break, right?
I think we are the egg somehow.
I mean,
we give those people, we grant them power. They are not intrinsically like an emperor because of themselves, because of their being or their position in power. A counselor only is a counselor and because people grant power to them. That was democracy means. But maybe we should come back to the hacker conference.
Yeah, maybe. I just want to highlight one last site you showed me. And I have some nice music lined up as well, so we can relax a bit after these busy days. But actually quite close to where you live, there is this palace of a certain warlord.
Prince again.
Yeah.
I can tell you a story again. We drove past it quite a few times. And TMC mentioned the Belvedere. This is a very beautiful palace close to the place where I live in Vienna. And it was given or bought for Prince Eugen after he won a series of very important battles for the emperor. And it is widely known, at least if you want to know it, that he was gay and also quite actively fulfilling out his desires. And he had this palace, which was somehow on the edges of the old Viennese, of the old Vienna. And it's funny because if you go to conservative ÖVP voters, they would not acknowledge the fact that he was gay. Although, I mean, there is a huge picture of him in the Belvedere when you go in the exhibition. And even there, it's quite obvious. And he on the one hand, he was a very brilliant warlord. He was brilliant in battle, but he also had, for example, there's the upper and the lower Belvedere. The upper Belvedere is the one, it's the bigger house. It's has even more gold on it and is really a typical symbol of power and status and wealth. And then you have the lower Belvedere, which is more like closer to the city and more people are in there. It's not only the emperor, it's also his servants and his maids and all those people. And he always used to sleep at the lower Belvedere, closer to the people, where he also had, I don't know, more cozy comfort.
Right. Now, I found that an interesting detail. You never hear anything about it in history.
Gay history, it's quite interesting. I mean, I get a visitor this weekend again from the UK. Carl, he is actually 62 now and studied history, and maybe I'll do a show with him about that. Mm. Maybe for talking anthropology.
That would he's also a science fiction writer, I understand. Because I was thinking this gay warlord thing, I read this theme in a science fiction novel. It's a space opera about I'm not going to bore people with that, but I actually forgot the name of the book. It's quite nice, but there was this, yeah. So I just remember that. Let's go to some music and gather ourselves again. Of course, it's all Creative Commons because that's what we are about. And this is Sebastian Gramont. I've played something from him before. Some nice Sunday afternoon relaxing lounge jazz.
And there we are again.
Ah, yeah, and of course the song ended earlier than we expected, but that doesn't matter. It was called, what was the name of the song, actually?
Oh my God, all this CC. Do I have, I don't yeah, want to you have explain to every song, credits and blah, blah.
No, you have to, because that's, yeah, you have to mention, well, I mentioned the artist and the song
Give
is...
Give me the flatter button, I'll click it, but I don't want to...
Mais où sont-ils passés? Of something like that, it's French.
Okay, let's talk about... some people may have noticed that our jingle today, tonight, whenever you hear it, was different than the usual signal jingle we all love. Yes, and that's because we put some pieces of a tape in
it. Yeah, these were actually the conference badges, right? They were tapes, like the old good old tapes that you used to do mixtapes on and put your games on and your demos in the early days.
Yeah, they all had the similar content. Only different colors for speakers, volunteers, and normal visitors. And the special thing about them was that he had two B-sides, of course, security B-sides, it's named the conference. Mm-hmm. And one B-side was full of music, some fancy cool stuff, a stereo tune, I haven't heard it. And the other B-side was a challenge made by Jeff Bramski.
I never asked for it last night, but it went something.
And you can hear Jeff right now. It's not a meditation for hackers, actually.
It could be adapted as such, but
pitch it a bit. But you had various segments in this audio track. I think you had.
It started with some Morse. I think it was SOS. Then you had some DTMF tones, which gave you a telephone number, which you had to dial. And I'm trying to remember. And then you got a URL.
The URL, I think, was at the end.
Yeah, no, you're right. You got the phone number. What was on the phone number? I'm not sure. We should research this before we talk about it. But anyway, the ones and the zeros...
I was cleaning up my area when they presented it, because it all was secret. Even we didn't know how it actually worked. But two friends of mine, independently from each other, cracked the code first. And what they explained to me was quite brilliant, because you had this 1010. That was the most trickiest part. The rest was quite obvious when you listened to it. just these two different approaches on... getting this 010 digitalized. The one is a quite arty programmer who heard this and thought, I know this new programming language, and there is the right EDA for it. And when I load the audio in it, and when I make a Fourier transform, and so on, I could somehow distinct these two, and then I can transform it. And yeah, and he somehow bought something like that, and... the approach of the other person was just, okay, I have 500 zeros and ones.
It was 590.
I just make it 30% slower and then just type it in.
Yeah, I actually looked at the waveform. Yeah, like we have here in the studio, we look at the waveform of the audio. You can quite distinctly see the zeros and the ones. So I actually thought about writing a script, but I never got around to that. I should have. Maybe I would have won third prize.
Yeah, I think with parametrical analysis, it would be also possible if you put it into Ableton or something like that.
Probably, but it's really distinctive, the form of the wave, and. Yeah, it's easy, but I didn't, so I shouldn't talk about how easy it was. But the beauty of it is you get a string of zeros and ones. And somehow I missed that part as well in the presentation, but you can determine a line length out of these things, and then you can interpret them as pixels. So you just put them beside each other. A zero is a white pixel, one is a black pixel, and then you get a square, sort of, approximately. And... which was a QR code, if you made the pixels large enough.
Yes.
And so you scan that, and then you got to the URL.
Yes, and on the URL, you basically already won, and you just had
to type in your name. Yeah. Yes. So who won?
We should have let the list. I think Jack, the map won.
Yeah. And he was second.
The first one was Riga. His last name is
yeah.
Riga.
Yeah. Stefan.
Stefan? Yeah, I think Stefan Riga.
No, it's on your. He did a talk.
He did what? Really?
He did a talk. Oh, right. He did. Yeah, but I mean, that was a nice challenge. It was something else than hack this computer or insert my SQL in this page. You know, this required some thinking. And
yeah, and Jeff is also quite brilliant at making this challenge batch combination. He has a fable for vintage media. He also used at a conference some old
display technology. The Nixie tubes, brilliant. These are beautiful. The old Russian. You basically have filaments for each. You have digits 1, 0, 1, 2, 3 till 9. So you have a tube for each digit. And there's filaments in there, one for the 0, one for the 1, one for the 2. And I'll spare the actual physics behind it, but you need some high voltage, and then you can select one of the filaments, and it will light up and show you the number. So these are really, if you're into retro, steampunk, whatever, these are the thing to have, the thing to implement. But he made conference badges out of them. So you would hang this around your neck, and there would be this PCB with a Nixie tube on it, and two AA batteries, and which is also quite, because you need to pump it up to, I don't know, 70, 90 volts to make them work, out of 3 volts. So, yeah, that's pretty nifty. And then you also could unlock achievements with it, I think, and pay drinks. And
wow.
Yeah, it is quite amazing.
There we have the eCash, the Russian version of it. Yeah, I'm totally amazed. He really does great stuff. And if you need really cool badges for your conference, then contact Jeff. We put him in a link list. I'm really totally blown away from the stuff. And that's not only just because I'm playing Fallout currently and totally into this steampunk
playing
thing.
What? Oh, Fallout.
Yes.
That's a game, playing. Apparently. Yeah, I'm okay, yeah.
And there was another moment in the conference where I was really blown away and was sitting close to Stara during the session chair at one talk, and there was a father sitting with his 7-year-old son. And at one moment, Stara and I realized that this 7-year-old was playing with this tape and totally fascinated by it, just because the fact he never saw one before, probably.
Yeah, wow.
And made me aware again of the time segments we're speaking about when it comes to this immensely fast revolution in technology that's going on. I mean, I'm from a generation, I'm still tapes, I know, yeah. Classical turntables are long before me, yeah. I only know from clubs.
Yeah.
And minidisc used to be fancy before I got an MP3 player. But,
That's funny, actually, because a friend of mine, he's an organizer of youth camps, and they have computers there, of course, to, keep them busy. It's all kinds of activities, and computers is one of them. So at some point, one of these kids walks up to him, I'm 12, 13-year-old, and he says, why is this icon? So I was pointing to the save icon in some program. What does it mean? What is this depiction? So this guy tells, well, it's a diskette. A what? So that's funny that programs we use are using depictions of technology that actually the latest generation has never seen. So
yeah, but it's that's a general feature of symbolic languages that. Intrinsically in the symbol never is any meaning. You have to know them from the context and from the application. I used to have a iRiver, it was called, was my first MP3 player, and it has a section where you could write text, and it still had a very old-fashioned pen and very old paper. And then when you went to the radio function of the MP3 player, you had very old vintage radio, and the symbols of things are always, I don't know, kind of first appearance, purest symbol, what just symbolized it when we first needed a word for it. And we still use or relate to these primary images or words. You can somehow, I see a similarity. I've been talking with many linguists in the last months, and when they explain me how they trace words, how they trace the origins of a language, it's also kind of similar, because we translate this word, just some people hear it from the people close by and think this is a useful word, or they describing with this word something, they also adapt, may it be kind of dish or a river or a street name, whatever. And we reuse this word, we borrow it. Not only borrowing, we're making it our own. It was quite funny. You said that in Dutch you have a few borrowed French words.
Yeah, quite
I actually don't think that you ever borrow a word. Words never belong to anyone.
No, no, but of course, this is the history of a country that reflects. We had Napoleon come in and take over our country, and quite a few concepts and things were introduced, and those words stuck. For example, the word that we use for the thing where you put your money in your wallet, it's a porte-monnaie, which comes from the French word for such a thing. So probably we what should I call it? We primitives did not know how to store our money, and then the French came and brought us this great invention, the wallet. And then
funny difference again. We treated Napoleon different. We just gave him one of our beautiful daughters of the emperor and let him marry. And that's what we did with the French quite often. But anyway. Coming back to the con, where that I was. One other talk I wanted to mention was, let me look up the title. What's second on mine? The Dark Side of Social Media, Measuring and Analyzing Malicious Activity on Twitter and Facebook by Daniel Peck.
Oh, yeah.
Who actually is a quite brilliant security researcher, and he gave us some insights into 2-year-long analysis they did out of the Twitter live stream. They somehow got one of this API keys where you can get a shitload of tweets from Twitter.
Yeah, you can easily get them, actually. Oh. Just send them a letter, like, I'm doing research, and then you're in.
Okay, good. Then he was making it up, and I got a feeling that it's quite fancy, and they had some kind of exclusive access to Twitter. And anyway, they analyzed basically quantitative statistical analysis, how many malicious links can you find within Twitter. And then they also categorized this the degree of maliciousness. And actually, it was a lot of spam, but it was only 1% real malicious links. And even of those, most were just trying to install a codec or something, also fraudware, but not particularly some worms or...
But that's one side of the social media and the black hat scene. I mean, this ties in with the talk about data exfiltration. If you look up the title, I will...
The attack UPnP thing?
No, that's the data exfiltration. It had Hollywood in the title.
Yeah. Not just for Hollywood, by... Oh my God, what's in the...
Zoom in, he was from Israel,
Litvak Lan Amit.
Yeah.
Okay, that was your track. I haven't seen that.
No, exactly. But it's basically the same. He also looked at part of the talk was about social media. So if you go into a company and you compromise their security, you get that data. The next step is, how do you get the data out of there and into your hands without it being traced back to you? So there's several techniques, and one of them is using social media, blogs, Facebook. You can post comments. So if you just encode the data somehow, then you get a string of text, and you can post it on a random blog or Wikipedia. You create an obscure article, and, well, there's the talk page. No one ever looks at that. Just dump it there in encrypted form, and you can grab it, and, well, no one knows it was you. But one of the fancier things he mentioned was using audio. So you could take a document, encode it somehow, encrypt it, and then use a musical scale to... basically play the piece as if it were music. So you get, well, a kind of abstract Mozart-y like music. But if you download that, it looks really innocent. It's a sound. And you download it, you can analyze it, decode it, and then you've got your data again.
It's funny. It reminds me of the idea of Nexito to do TCP over spam. It's like, what curious ways can one invent to get data over some... Yeah, if you want to call it medium. But a nice idea of tunneling. But good. We obviously had a lot of interesting talks. And
absolutely.
Have you seen this attacking UPnP thing?
Yeah.
Because many people said, oh, that's great, that was the best talk. And I haven't seen it because I was on the other track.
Luckily, it's all recorded, so with some luck, we will see them appear. But it was a great... Phoenix was doing the talk, and Yeah, UPnP is this funny protocol, you know. He calls it the remote firewall disabling protocol. And it is what it is. You send some packets to your router. You say, I want this port to be open now. And without an authentication or whatever, I mean, the whole concept of authentication does not exist in the UPnP world. So if you have access to the network or somehow can make the router think that what you send is from the network, you can just open ports, set forwards.
Yeah, the basic idea for our non-technical listeners is basically you just want to, from the inside, you are a program, you want to be reachable from outside, and so you tell the router, please open this hole for me.
Yeah, because normally your router will not let traffic from...
Traffic from outside in, usually only... Yeah. The connection has to be started from inside out. And once a connection is open, also traffic can flow back. But if a connection is started from the outside, usually it's rejected.
And this is also, it's good that you mentioned this actually, because I'm immediately diving into the technical details. UPnP is quite useful because a lot of protocols depend on the ability of others to go from the internet into your network, into your computer to, well, for example, MSN depends on it. The torrent downloading protocol depends on it. Yeah. So as an end user, you don't know what firewalls are or how to configure. You don't want to be bothered with that. So UPnP handles that for you automatically because, the MSN client will send this UPnP request to your router. You don't notice this. It just goes over your network and the port will be opened and you can communicate. And so what are you going to do if you want, it is insecure, it's a big hole in everyone's network and it's in everyone's home, but what are you going to do, say turn it off and then explain your grandma how she has to configure her firewall router so that she can continue to chat with her grandchildren?
It's a consumer feature and it's a consumer idea. I want to exclude the user from his decision and let the program and the router decide how the structure of the network has to look like. We're getting quite technical if we explain it in more detail, I think. But basically, no one's going to die. And I think the most users who, 90% of those would never even notice if UPnP is not activated on their router. Just because MSN is not working, okay, I'm going to use another chat program or... MSN may have to switch protocol to...
Maybe. Meanwhile, it is on and no one's motivated to change it. And you can use it to attack the innocent user. And identity theft is quite real these days. I mean, UPnP can be a factor to steal someone's credit card data. So it's really amazing that the vendors just sell these boxes with UPnP because it's convenient. It's totally insecure and it puts you at risk.
Yeah, just too convenient and not paranoid enough for this world. I know.
Yeah.
But what was the message of the talk again?
That there's a lot more coming on this front. He's going to do a lot more research. I think Apple has a similar protocol.
Yeah, it's Net UPnP.
Yeah. He's basically saying, watch out, this is going to be mind-blowing.
And last talk on my track was how to give a lousy presentation by the beloved Mac Lemon. We had this talk the 2010 year also in NinjaCon, and he's just brilliant. If you ever gave a presentation at some point, you will find yourself in his talk.
I missed it because I was in the other track, so I want to see. I saw a few bits of it.
Yeah, ninjacon.net. Hopefully soon there will be recordings. The last 2 years we didn't make it. It was not my fault. I won't say whose fault it was. But yeah, this year we streamed. We have everything recorded and it should be online soon.
So I'm visiting this conference. I'm from The Hague, and I started there traveling. I visited a couple of hackerspaces along the way, which was great. I met a lot of people. I call this tour the last ninja tour, because it sort of is the last NinjaCon in Vienna, but it's not going to be the last one.
Yeah, Astera is taking this conference with her to Berlin, which is kind of good, because I think with that it wouldn't be the same. But it was not only Astera, it was also Christian O'Reilly who...
Yep.
It was his idea of doing security B-sides here in Vienna, and then those two just paired and made one conference out of it. And I think Chris will continue, and we'll see if we have something in 2012 in Vienna. Because actually Vienna is lacking an event like that. We have high-class security conferences like the first, like DeepSec, but we don't have anything that cozy and open for a broader audience like that. It's just... in this sense, unique, and Vienna would really lack something. I hope the team can gather again, and then we see something similar popping up. Otherwise, we all have to go to Berlin, which we have to do anyway, sooner or later.
Yeah, but then we have to be in Berlin all the time. You know, we have the CCC Congress. We have, pH neutral, not anymore. Not that I mind going to Berlin, but I like seeing other places as well.
Yeah, but speaking about irreversible German, speaking about the unavoidable German hub, I think we have to say something about the camp as well.
Yeah.
And we're gonna do a radio project there.
As far as I understood,
real 24/7 coverage of the conference.
Not necessarily all about the conference, but we're going to do a 24/7 studio. The intention is to have 24/7 programming, although maybe at early hours there might be some auto DJ playing. But in general, people are just still awake, and they say, let's do a show. But it's going to be quite diverse, actually. It's the same people who did the radio station at Heart 2009 are involved again. And it's going to be a mix between news, actualities, but also background and more in-depth programs. And aside of that, there's also going to be fun and less serious but entertaining programs. So it's really going to be a mix. And there's a lot of people who have recently discovered that making radio is actually quite fun, because a friend of mine, he always thought, like, he went to the events, Heart 2009, ETH0, and we were doing radio there and having lots of fun. But he thought, I'm not going to do that because I would suck at it and I would mess it up. But it's really fun to do radio. I love doing radio. And this friend of mine, he discovered that actually, because he's also into house music from the 80s in Holland, and he sort of took over a classic program in the Netherlands and makes a new version of that, playing old records but also new records using the same format. And he's done that twice now, and he's completely turned over. He says, I love this. I want to do more. It's once you start doing it, it's
great. Kind of addictive. And this love to the microphone, you only can get it when you're really doing an actual show. I mean, you're often doing shows live, which is another quality that's added to it. But I think you have to find this mixture, your personal mixture, between hiding behind music and doing as bare radio and talk as possible.
True.
And speaking about the camp, I definitely am very, very eager to participate in this project, because it's been soon more than 2 years that I'm doing this, and I really would like to experiment more. I know a few things, a few formats I developed work quite well. And if I soon finish my university degree, I will go on with that in a classical discursive talk radio format like Chaos Radio Express, but only with a scientific focus on cultural, anthropological, technical topics. And the thing with the camp situation is that you have this massive amount of interesting, cool people.
Thousands of, yeah.
And I definitely would like to draw a lot of those into the program and just get interesting interviews out there. One thing is coverage. Like we did it last year, the show we moderated about the Congress.
Yeah, yeah, at the Congress, Rome,
The live Congress covered. That was actually quite nice, and really it was a fire probe for me because I never ever did something similar like that. Originally it was planned that Astero would moderate with me, and then Astero got sick and I had ended up moderating a live show with 10 guests.
Yeah, oh, that was amazing, yeah. I loved it. There were great discussions, but it's what you're saying, that there's different ways of going at it, at doing radio. I've been doing live shows, purely live, just getting people on the phone, talk with them. But I've also, if I'm on travels, I always have my recorder with me. If I'm talking with someone and he has an interesting project, I might as well just record the talk. And then when I get home, I can cut out the interesting bits. And there you go, another 10, 15 minutes that I can insert in a show. And there's lots of ways of doing this. So it's not all live that I do. Actually, this is one of the things I am personally planning to do also on the camp, which I hope you will help me with, is doing a workshop, how to make radio, how to make live radio, how to just give people like an insight in the basic things of how to operate a mixer, which sounds, I mean, if you look at it, there's a lot of buttons, it can look quite intimidating. If you understand what it is, it's quite straightforward. But also things like how to, if you got step up to someone and just ask them questions, then it helps to think about what you are going to say, and it helps to ask questions that you already know the answer to, but that doesn't matter because the listener does not.
Yeah, no, there's always a journalistic and technical level to it, and the technical things you basically can scale. You can start with a 100 euro recording device or a 10 euros headset, or you can be in a radio studio like we are now and have a few hundred euros worth of mixer here and expensive AKG microphones. Hopefully, I definitely will participate, and hopefully I will have my studio equipment. I'm also investing 1,000 euros to finally get something I'm happy with, because so far I'm switching microphones and equipments for 2 years now, and I want to have something that's stable and that's also operational on a level, and also get away from the Skype thing, really. Yeah. I would like to get in touch with people and really look them in the eye, and I know I always have to do Skype just because there are so many interesting people outside of Vienna, and I cannot travel as much as I wish to, so I have to use Skype. But generally, this experience of meeting someone and really catching the thing they really want to say or have to say, that's what radio is about for me.
Absolutely.
And also, just to add something up, because in the camp, I think we have to step away from our politics of English-only content. Also because we are broadcasting over classical radio frequency and also Freifunker Amateur. I think we have several ways of distributing it. Over
there. We're going to be on the airwaves in the area. Absolutely, yeah. We're going to have our own transmitter and no. Okay. But we are going to do it. There will be even content in Dutch actually. So yeah, I'm all for it. Sure. I mean, we have 24 hours to fill, and we are just going to do it. But I wanted to. I mean, we're almost running out of time. We've got like 2 minutes left.
Oh fuck!
It's great that this station, it just exists without. In the Netherlands, you have either the local radios, which are government funded, or the commercial ones who just sell advertisement time and can buy this ridiculously expensive license to broadcast this frequency. But this station, and like the one in New York, WBAI, which brings a great show of Emmanuel Goldstein of 2600, it's also funded. There's no commercials on the... Okay, so once every while they have these fundraisers. They have shows that are exclusively about asking the listeners to donate to the station, and that's what they survive on, just donations from the listeners. And I think that's great, because in the Netherlands there is not something like that. I would love there to be, but it's all institutionalized. You either are a public broadcasting company, or you are a local, locally sanctioned, or you are a commercial entity.
Don't go into this topic, because after listening to Tim Pritlove so much, I really think that this is a never-ending subject, and I could go for hours with that, for the future of radio, where it's going for, and all those things. It will be definitely interesting on the camp. One thing I have to mention on that as well is the MetaLab group will again have the Leivand Will over, and we have one particular project I want to turn out. I want to name specifically. It is a radio project. We will broadcast with a fucking long antenna up to the moon, let the signal reflect from the moon and then come back to us with 1 second of latency. So far, that's the theory. We'll see how it works out. But just the idea of it is so fucking brilliant. And also, some way of radio.
I like the idea of I'm into connecting networks through novel ways. And this is one that I could take into account. But we are really running out of time.
Yeah, maybe we cut the outro out. I don't know. One thing we have to add as well, our names and a call for participation. Signal is needing more content because recently more and more people from other shows have been lazy with their productions. And we still are...
Well, you cancelled your last one.
I'm doing one now. I'm writing a bachelor thesis and I did a conference and don't sleep. No, anyway, that was the lovely GMC.
that's me, GMC. Yeah, and the other guy talking, that's a social hack.
Well, thank you. Yeah, other guy. The other guy. Good. Then that's it for today from Vienna. We hopefully wish you that you may look at the conference recordings and maybe we see you on NinjaCon 2012 in Berlin. Or the camp.
I'm looking forward to that already.
Okay.
Good evening.
Goodbye.